Crescera coming to you from here in Los Angeles, California. Welcome to all of you who took the time to listen in here tonight. I really appreciate your taking the time from your busy schedule to be here. We have 63 people on the line tonight. Thank you for all listening in. I want to add that if any of you listeners want to ask a question, please send them to us during the teleseminar by email at info@contractorselling.com, and we will get to your questions at the end of the meeting. Also, I must tell you that this teleseminar is being held in lecture mode, so you will be unable to talk or make comments during the session. But if you hang in there, you would like to talk to someone about what you hear on the call tonight, just call us toll-free at 877-764-6304 at the end of the meeting, and I'll be glad to direct you to the right resources to make sure you get all the information you need about what you're hearing tonight. As I said before, my name is Joe Crescera, and I'm a national sales educator and contracting business consultant that specializes in a unique method that creates quantum leap success in people who sell services in the contracting trade, such as plumbers, HVAC, electrical technicians. Now, you can reach me anytime by going to www.contractorselling.com and going to the correct link and contacting us, and then you can email or call me. I will have with me tonight a special guest. His name is Ed Priz. Priz from who has authored a book which has been published by Entrepreneur Magazine. The name of the book is called The Ultimate Guide to Workers' Compensation Insurance, The Secrets of Reducing Workers' Comp Costs. Ed is joining us tonight from his home located just outside of Chicago, Illinois. Ed, I want to welcome you to this event to help contractors reduce their workers' comp costs. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure.
Well, great. I'm glad to have you here. This is a subject that is near and dear to all of our hearts as contractors, and not one that's usually met with most enthusiasm. But
I know.
But nonetheless, it's going to be very interesting. So, Ed, let's talk about your involvement in the workers' comp industry. And when you mention the word workers' comp to a contractor, it's not usually met with enthusiasm, as I said,
no.
To say the least. But what is it exactly that you do? And how did you get started in the business of trying to help business people reduce their workers' comp expenses?
I'm in kind of a unique business. I am a consultant. I don't sell insurance. I actually make my living double-checking what insurance companies have charged employers for their workers' comp. So I come in and look over audits and try and find mistakes the insurance company has made that has caused the premiums to be higher than they really should be. And I've been doing this kind of work for a while. It's I set up 20 years ago, and I was actually doing this kind of work for a few years even before that, working for someone else. But I started actually as an insurance producer, an insurance agent and broker, just working a lot in the workers' compensation field. And then back in the early 80s, I was working at an insurance agency in downtown Chicago that also had a consulting company. And after a year or so, I ended up starting to work with the consulting company, and because I had some background with workers' comp, we started gradually getting into this area of double-checking how the insurance companies had figured premiums. And one thing led to another, and within a year or two of that, I was on this career path that I've been ever since, that is spending all my time just finding errors by the insurance companies.
Wow. I'll tell you what, when I came across your book, I was pleasantly surprised because – you are in an industry that there's not very much out there, not very much information, and it's almost scary as the lack of information that's out there about this. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. The folks who pay the premiums, the policyholders, a lot of the time are at a terrible disadvantage. There's lots of information because there are lots of rules and manuals of rules that govern how these premiums are supposed to be calculated, but they're not very accessible to the employer who has to pay the premiums.
Yeah, I think especially in regards to contractors who are generally just too busy just running their business and putting out emergencies, and I think that they fall prey or victim to the lack of useful information or not being able to have the opportunity to review this information. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, and I mean, normally they rely on their insurance agent or broker to hopefully, you know, they're relying on them to catch a lot of these things. And unfortunately, even really good insurance agents and producers typically aren't given much authority by the insurance companies to do much about this. So even when disputes arise, insurance agents can they can try and represent the interests of their client with the insurance companies, but oftentimes I find that insurance companies just they take with very large grains of salt anything the insurance agent is telling them if it's running contrary to what the insurance company wants to hear.
Well, I suppose in that sense, it sounds like the insurance industry has segments within the industry, sort of like heating, air conditioning, or plumbing companies that have a service technician and maybe an installation technician. And a lot of times we just think that, I'm sure people from the outside of an air conditioning or heating company or plumbing company or electrician think that everybody's just the same, like they're all heating guys. They don't realize that just like there's specialties in the heating trade, that it takes somebody like you to focus in on this segment of the business.
Absolutely. And, I mean, the insurance industry, they have very specialized departments within their operations to do the underwriting of these policies and to do the auditing of these policies. And the people who actually are out in the field selling the insurance and who are the primary interface with the policyholders, their level of understanding of a lot of the detail of this stuff varies considerably.
Right. Well, Ed, when I review the cost of workers' comp premiums from year to year, and I have the opportunity to look at a lot of my clients' internal books because they're trying to find ways to decrease expenses and increase revenue. Of course, I do specialize in increasing revenue, but part of it is to also save money, too, if we can. I find that the cost of workers' comp is like a roller coaster. In both cases, it goes up and down, and at the end, I'm sick at the end of the ride. How does the industry figure workers' comp premiums in general?
Well, it's funny. I often say, you know, outsiders, I think, sometimes buy into the stereotype that insurance pricing is this extremely rational, extremely, you know, by-the-book sort of exercise, sort of like with Mr. Spock-type characters in the back room with their computers, and it's all coming out to be, you know, it's got to be what this number is. But the reason for this roller coaster effect you talk about is that one of the biggest factors that affect the premiums most people pay is market conditions. In most states where there's a competitive insurance market, where private insurance companies are involved, there can be huge swings from year to year because the insurance companies are, you know, their pricing of the insurance is very sensitive to the condition of the insurance market in any given year. In a soft market, insurance companies are competing on price, so they're using all their discretionary credits to lower premiums if they think it's necessary to get business on the books. But then when the market turns hard, as it kind of shifted just a couple of years ago, it can turn make a huge difference from one year to the next, and suddenly all those discretionary credits are turning into discretionary debit charges. And maybe nothing very different has occurred at the policyholder, but suddenly the workers' comp premiums have shot up. You know, maybe they've doubled from one year to the next. And it isn't the biggest factor is just that this year the insurance companies have decided they can charge whatever the market will bear.
I get that impression. It's like when I had insurance people in. And getting prices from them and doing the whole, you know, year to year kind of checking out what I should pay and reviewing who I should use. I think the presentation, you're correct. It seems like it's kind of modified to make it sound like this is coming from Big Brother. I have nothing to do with these prices. These are something that's coming from up above.
Yes, and they will always try and justify it in very objective sounding, very rational sounding terms. But behind the scenes, what's often going on is the underwriter is figuring out, okay, based on the loss information available to me, what number do I want to hit? What premium do I want to charge so that I make sure I have enough money coming in to cover the losses I expect, plus to build in my expenses and build in some profit. And so they figure this number in advance, and then they kind of work backwards from that number and say, okay, so here's the payrolls and the classifications. What do we have to do to get to this number I've already picked out in advance?
Yeah. You know what? I think that contractors could probably learn from that process. I think that's probably a smart way to go into know what kind of profit and all your costs you have to make, and then that's your price that you have to charge, as opposed to many contractors, I think, kind of priced the way the market bears, as opposed to, or they price based on just a little bit less or more than their competition. So,
well, the insurance industry will still, I mean, they'll start out from that point. That's usually what they call a loss pick. But what will happen is, if the market is very soft, if there's a competitive market for insurance, and they really want this piece of business, they may well start negotiating down from that point, because the agent or the policyholder is saying, well, I've got a better quote from somebody else, so if you want to have a shot at this, you've got to cut your price. So that's what happens typically in soft markets when there is competition. But one factor, of course, that contractors always face is that, generally speaking, there is less competition for their workers' compensation business than there is for other kinds of businesses. There are a lot of insurance companies that are eager to write workers' compensation for some kinds of risk, but there are fewer companies that are really interested in writing a lot of contract risks. So there's less competition for their business, unfortunately, which means there's less price competition.
Now, Ed, I know the insurance industry has told many contractors that one of the built-in negotiation factors that they tell contractors about is, of course, the mod factor, or kind of a discount or anti-discount factor based on the experience of the contractor and what exposure he has had, or what do you call it, the accidents and so forth he's had in the past. Why don't you just briefly give us an overview of what the mod factor is and how it affects pricing.
Sure. And you're right, it is a very fundamental part of workers' compensation pricing, and I spend a fair bit of time in the book talking about that as well. And it's an area that we oftentimes find errors in as well. The experience modification factor is a calculation that's done every year, and it basically compares the loss information that's been reported for your company. It compares that to what's been computed to be the average losses of everybody in your state who's doing the same kind of work. So the insurance companies, they report to a rating bureau what they say your loss information is. Normally it uses 3 years, but it can be calculated on fewer than that if 3 years aren't available. So, but normally it's 3 years worth of loss information. And then the insurance company also reports your past audited payrolls by classification for those years, because the rating bureau figures up what's been the average loss per $100 of payroll for everybody in those same classifications in the state. So they take your losses, compare it to the average losses of other people in your state, and they come up with a comparison. So if your losses are 75% of what the average would be, you're going to get a mod of 0.75, which means you're going to get a 25% discount on your premium.
Mm-hmm.
But when they run your losses through the same formula, if in the next year it turns out that your losses turned out to be 125% of what the average would be, you're going to get a 1.25 experience mod, which means a 25% surcharge over the minimum premium.
Now, this is a huge factor. How can contractors be sure that their mod is being expressed correctly? And also, touch on the fact you said do the same work. Is it possible for a plumber that may sound like a plumber, but maybe he does like commercial, or it must be higher exposure for a plumber who works on top of the Sears Tower as opposed to a plumber who would work in the home?
Not necessarily. It depends.
No?
Because it all tracks off of the classification code that's on your policy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a limited number of classification codes.
Mm-hmm.
In most states, they use a classification system that has somewhere between 500 and 600 different classification codes. They've been tinkering with it a little bit, so the actual number varies. Now, there are, in addition to those set national classifications, there can also be what they call state specials. So each individual state might have a handful of classifications where their definitions may be a little bit different. So you really, to be really exact about classifications, you have to look at what particular state you're talking about as well. But generally speaking, there's only this limited number of classifications. So a lot of times the classification system doesn't differentiate into such fine detail, say, between a plumber who might be doing one kind of work and a plumber who's doing another kind. Typically, in most states, there's going to be one plumbing classification. And someone who's working in somebody's home is thrown into the same class as someone who's doing industrial piping.
That's interesting. Just one more thing about that worker, the mod issue. The question I was going to ask you was the mod being figured. Does the does the agent, is it in the best interest of you, or should we trust what the agent just tells us this is your classification, or should you have access to the classifications to make sure that you have you are in the right one?
Mistakes in classification are one of the most common errors we find. So, in our consulting work, we do an awful lot of work on a contingent fee basis, where we only earn a fee if we find a mistake and actually get the money back for the client. So if the insurance industry wasn't making an awful lot of mistakes out there, we wouldn't be able to make a living doing this stuff.
It wouldn't be in business, right.
And like I said, I've been doing this work for a long time now. So year in, year out, they make a lot of mistakes. And mistakes in classification is probably the number one mistake we find. So it absolutely is in a policyholder's interest to do some research and double-check. Try and find out as much as you can about, are you really in the right classification?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, Ed, I have talked to very many people or contractors this past year in particular who have, you know, sold a lot of stuff and who have put a lot of books on the hours and have grown their company due to the warm summer we had last year and just some other factors like selling things at a better process, which means if you sell more stuff, you're going to accumulate more hours. How does this type of success affect the possibility of audits, and how does it affect audits?
Well, insurance companies, I mean, theoretically, insurance companies should be auditing almost every policy in existence, except for the very smallest ones. But from a practical standpoint, if the premium on a policy is relatively small, they may well not do a full audit. They may just, for a very small premium, they might just send out a form to the policyholder and say, please fill in what your actual payrolls were for this period, et cetera. For a little bit larger premium, they might conduct an audit just over the telephone. But once your premium size gets to be in the neighborhood of, you know, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year, they are probably going to want to send out an auditor physically out to review your books to make sure that that they're getting all the premium that they think is due them.
Yeah, you know what? That's very interesting because there are a lot of companies in the contracting industry that kind of bootstrap it and start up. You know, they don't start up with a lot of money, and they don't go from zero to, you know, $3 million in business overnight. What happened to me, actually, was I started out with just basically by myself with another person and grew the company, you know, to be very large. But it was funny because I never even heard of an audit when I was smaller, and all of a sudden at some level, like you said, when I start getting into the $25,000 to $30,000 level of premium, all of a sudden I noticed the guy showed up at my door.
Yeah, that's typically how they determine who's going to be audited. They just go by premium size.
Yes, I think that's a good lesson. Would you say that for smaller contractors to be expecting some kind of an audit or actually somebody showing up or making an appointment with you to come up and take a look at this situation, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So you answered my question. Not everybody gets an audit, but only when it's probably when it's cost effective on the insurance company's
exactly.
part to make sure that it's making sense. Now, remember, if any of you listeners want to ask a question, please email them to us during the teleseminar at info@contractorselling.com. Many contractors just think the audit is correct every single time, Ed. How many audits would you say are not done correctly, percentage-wise?
I can tell you this. In our consulting practice, we find year in and year out that we find significant errors in somewhere between one-third to one-half of the programs we review. So it doesn't mean necessarily that a mistake is made in every single year when the audit's done. But so when we work with a client, you know, we might look over 3 or 4 or 5 years' worth of audits. But in somewhere between one-third and one-half of those times when we look, we're going to find a significant mistake in at least one of those audits, in some kind of thing. Either it's in the classification, or it's in the experience mod, or it's in how the audit itself was done.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long does it take? I mean, you know, it's funny when you say that, because I'm sure if a electrician or a plumber were to look at their work or look at a home and look at the electrical system of a home, for instance, they could pretty much tell sometimes there's some red flags that they see that indicates that there's an issue here in the home and we got to look further into this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case with what you're doing? Did you kind of see some red flags that you how long does it take you to find a red flag that alerts you to say this might be some issues we have to look into?
I mean, there are some things that jump out very, very quickly. I mean, some of the other things we find in our examination, that takes a little more digging. But there are some what we do call red flags that say, oh, this at least needs to be looked at more carefully. Things like if a company's classification code has changed in recent years, that definitely warrants looking deeper into, because if they've changed you recently, it means, one, maybe this new classification that they put you in, especially if it's a more expensive class, it should be double-checked. Do you really belong in that more expensive classification? If they've moved you to a lower classification now, in more recent years, that's great, but that would mean that probably in the past when you were in that more expensive class, you were being overcharged, because usually when they change classification, it isn't because, the employers changed what they do. It's because somebody's understanding of how you fit into the classification scheme has evolved. So you've gone to a new insurance company and someone's new taking a look at it, and they say, oh, God, the other guy had you in this class, but you really belong over here. But so whenever there's a change in classification, we say it ought to be looked at carefully. Another red flag can be if there's been something abrupt that increased premiums after the policy starts, where the insurance company endorses some new change under the policy in the middle, or they make a change at the audit. In a lot of states, for instance, it's now against the rules to change a company to a more expensive classification at the audit. But not too long ago, that was okay under the rules. It was, and insurance companies and insurance company auditors got accustomed to the idea that it was an auditor's job to be looking to see if they needed to be moved into a more expensive classification. But nowadays, if they moved you to a more expensive class, at least in a lot of states, that's really against the rules. Mm-hmm. But the insurance company, nobody's looking over their shoulder, so the insurance companies just kind of, they'll go ahead and do it, and if somebody yells about it, then they'll look and maybe they'll back off. But if nobody yells, it'll just go through.
There's no, if the tree fell in the forest and nobody saw it, it never did fall, did it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness, that's a good one. You know, I never thought about that. That's why I love your book. I tell you, I read your book, and I thought I knew a lot of different angles about this whole subject, because I used to look. I'm famous for looking under every rock I can find to make sure I didn't overspend my money. but I tell you what, after reading your stuff, I found what I do and then some. It was I found myself only doing about probably 10% of all the stuff that you as a professional, look at. And I suppose when you change companies, or when you shop for workers' comp and you change a company in midstream, or you aren't using the same company every year, I suppose that probably makes you fall prey to that classification change, and also what the hours that your premium quote is being based on. I have seen that before, where an insurance company came in and quoted me. It seemed like it was cheaper. The truth was they raised the classification on me and then quoted fewer hours, and then it turned into a thing where I thought I was paying less, and I wound up with a pretty large audit at the end.
It's something, we call it, I'm sure they use it in a lot of industries as well, but just lowballing, where someone, when they're coming in with the proposal for insurance, if you're only looking at the bottom line of what they're saying the premium will be, sometimes someone can pull a bit of a fast one, because when workers' comp policies begin, the premium by necessity has to be estimated. And the actual cost for the policy is only going to be determined after the policy ends, when they do an audit. So that estimated premium is based on, you have to plug in a certain amount of payroll. It's the payroll goes gets allocated among different classifications. Each classification has a different manual rate. So when you're comparing proposals for insurance, for instance, you really have to put them side by side and make sure, are these things apples to apples in terms of, are they using the same payroll? Is the payroll allocated among the different classification codes the same way? Are they using the same experience mods? There can be discretionary factors between one insurance company and another, and that's a legitimate way for insurance companies to compete on price.
Sure.
So
like
if one company is giving you a 25% credit and the other company is giving you no discretionary credit, that's a legitimate discount to you. But if the reason that Company B's proposal looks cheaper is because they're using less payroll in their estimate, that's not a real savings, because when the audit's done, they're going to figure out what the actual payroll was and apply that. So, that estimated premium, that apparent savings in the proposal is going to evaporate.
Well, you just gave me a great idea, and I think that based on what you're saying, then it probably would be wise for a contractor to make up a spec sheet of some sort, or some kind of a predefined way that we're going to look at these things, I would say, wouldn't you?
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's interesting. I never thought of that, because I think a lot of people just, what it is, most contractors are bottom liners, and we don't do it that way. We don't like to be honest, we don't even like talking to insurance people, and then
I
And then when one comes in the door, it's like, yeah, go ahead and have at it, and let me know what the numbers are. And then we just, all we do is look at that bottom of that sheet, like you're saying.
Yep.
And that's a big, one of our biggest downfalls, I would say, probably.
The other tricky thing that can happen in the proposal stage of it is that, you know, sometimes folks who aren't in the insurance business, they kind of assume, well, the insurance agent will sometimes foster this impression by saying, oh, yeah, I have access to all the different companies out there. You don't need to get a bunch of different agents or brokers involved in this. But that's not really true. Most independent agents, they may have contracts with only a limited number of companies.
Right.
So if you want to make sure you're really getting lots of competitive proposals, you might need to be talking to more than one insurance producer, more than one insurance agent.
Hmm.
Now, especially with contractors, you can't go too crazy with that because there are only limited markets for most contractors' businesses. So you can't bring in a half a dozen different guys because they're just going to trip over each other, and it'll actually work against you because when the insurance companies, if they start getting multiple submissions from different agents, they're just going to say, ah, they're going to throw it out, put it in the bottom of the pile. They're not even going to work seriously on it.
I'm with
so
you, yeah.
You've got to really manage that process a bit.
Yeah, I can understand that. Let's go right to the audits now. We have running kind of some limited time here. So let's go over some of the biggest mistakes that can occur during an audit that can cost contractors tens of thousands of dollars in miscalculated premiums. How should you set the environment for the audit, and where should it be held?
Generally speaking, I recommend you make sure the audit is being done at your premises, if at all possible. Now, I mean, the auditor, he's going to want, or she, I should say, also, you know, he or she is going to want to be able to look at a lot of the financial documents. So sometimes these audits are done over at, say, the accountant's office because that's where all the records are at. But that can create a problem because the people at the accountant's office may not understand the details of your work as well as they might. And so when the auditor is trying to figure out about proper classifications, he might not be able to get the right answers, and then he's going to end up using a wrong classification for some of your payroll. So ideally, you want to have it where, yeah, they've got access to all the records they need, but they've also have access to someone from your company who really understands the fine detail of what does this group of people do and what does that department do, so that you can make sure that there's no misunderstandings, because typically when there's misunderstandings, it raises the premium.